Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
This is Bob Hill. And Miss Wishy, I notice there's a boiling pot of newts over here in the corner. Did you bring those
That's
in with you?
That's just for you. I'm hoping it's my...
That's the newt diet?
It's the going to be the solution to all my problems.
I can't help you with that.
No, there's no newts boiling.
But there's other things boiling here.
There are other things boiling here. And, you know, it is Halloween. People start to think about these things, of course. And we came across a great little book on black plants, and we thought, what better time of the year than to address it? It's something that I think people don't really look at very much. We're more engaged by cheery things and bright colors and, you know, that sort of thing. And there's hundreds of black plants out there. I was surprised there were so many.
Yeah, a man named Paul Bonine owns a nursery in Oregon, or co-owner of a nursery in Oregon. And I kind of want to warn listeners, get your pencil and some paper and a pen out, because we're going to list about 10 or 12 plants that have black touches. Some are more black than others. But sometimes you mention plants so quickly, you can't write them down. So we're going to mention a dozen or so.
Yeah, and we'll have more information about them on our website at WFPL.org as well. But yeah, black plants and good ideas in terms of how to mix them in your garden well. You can't just throw them in anywhere, because sometimes they have a tendency to disappear.
And then there's some black magic coming up.
There are some black magic coming up. But really, I think the foundation of it all is how some people really do look to nature for their spirituality.
Right.
And we're going to talk with author and master gardener and Wiccan and witch, who's from St. Louis. Her name's Ellen Dugan, and she practices the Wicca religion, which basically is the base of their spirituality is nature and some other things. So we wanted to look into that during this Halloween season and sort of get the straight story on Halloween as well, perhaps. It may surprise you, the origins of it all.
Yes.
So Ellen Dugan will be joining us on Homegrown today. So we'll get a lesson in witchery and how it relates to our gardens that we all love.
Just don't disappear on me in the middle of this.
I won't. And you do call me Miss Witch sometimes. So I think that this is probably right up my alley.
Okay. Up your broom.
How about that? Yeah. All right. So we hope you stick with us today on Homegrown. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Two things. One, we nervously moved about 25 or 30 peonies this past weekend.
Uh-huh.
Always a tricky proposition because, you know, the
Why
old
nervous?
Thing about it. Well, because,
Just
you know,
the depth.
Yeah, the depth thing, which we're very cautious of. But they've been in the ground for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
These are big, thick, incredibly almost stumpy looking plants, but they've gotten in the shade after 15 years.
Right.
So we had to move them. And I moved six tree peonies, which are close.
That would be scary.
That was scary. Close to God for me. But it's the time to do it in the fall. If you're going to move your peonies and they're getting too much shade, as mine were, move them.
Yeah.
Other thing is my arum are coming up again. And arum is a fun plant that, as you know, has foliage all winter and dies down in the spring. So nobody ever sells it because it's never around when the nurseries are open.
You know what? You're right.
You never see it. Never see it in nurseries.
I've got a great stand of it.
I do too.
It's a great ground cover.
Theodore Klein gave me mine. So anyway, folks, look up arum, ARUM, in the catalog, and put it in your yard.
Yes, put it in, and it can tolerate some shade. It can actually tolerate pretty full sun situations too.
Foliage all winter,
and even if we have like a really hard cold period, it may sort of droop a little bit, kind of like your hellebores.
Back it comes.
It's a great plant.
How about the wishy state? What's up?
Okay, update. I wanted to tell you that I am getting figs after all. A couple of weeks ago, I talked about how we were afraid that we weren't going to get any figs ripening. Loaded, but we were afraid that we weren't going to get any, and we're getting them, and it's nice. I can eat.
No more fig tears.
They're doing well. And I think one of them has gotten so large, Andy wants to try to protect it, like wrap some stuff around it, protect it to see if we can get it through the winter, just to see if we can get it really, really, really large. So we may play around with that, and we'll let you know how it goes, of course. And then, Bob, I planted, when we were at Fresh Start Grower Supply, I bought some of their soil building cover crop mix.
Right.
And I planted a cover crop in the vegetable garden plots. And
what's in it?
It's different types of peas and like legumes, basically. So the nitrogen fixing.
Yeah.
And then like some rye grass, some oats, that sort of thing. Those are the, you remember earlier in the spring when we were talking about like building soil?
Yeah.
Somebody had emailed us about radishes.
Right.
Like to break up clay soils.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
These plants have root systems that go really deep. So they help to break up clay soils. And then in the spring of the year, you turn it all over and you add, it's adding organic matter. The legumes help to fix the nitrogen. Do you know what I mean? So it's just, but they call it a green manure.
And it pops up in about 2 weeks, right?
It should pop up pretty quickly and then be there. And guess what else it does? It's like a mulch all winter long.
Yeah.
So you have less weeds.
Less weeds. That was my next comment.
It's fabulous, yeah. So if you've got, if you're getting serious about your vegetable gardening, get a cover crop planted out there right now. It'll serve probably a handful of really good gardening purposes for your springtime growing.
That seems kind of magic when it works.
You know what? You're absolutely right. It is magic the way
it works. The witches help you out?
It's nature doing what nature does, and witches have definitely helped me out.
Okay.
The philosophy is something that I think makes a lot of sense to this gardener. But yeah, we've got Ellen Dugan joining us now for a little more detail on that. Ellen is an award-winning author, clairvoyant, and practicing Wiccan in St. Louis, where she's written over a dozen books on the practical side of witchery, many of which are grounded in the garden. A few of her books of note include Garden Witchery, Magic from the Ground Up, Herb Magic, Cottage Witchery, and The Garden Witch's Herbal. All of these are published by Llewellyn Press. Ellen, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Sure. Listen, I really want to clear up the whole, like, witch Wiccan philosophy thing, because I'm sure that in and around, you know, October and Halloween, people are probably a little bit more interested in your philosophy and what you do. But honestly, when I was looking into it, and I was telling Bob about it, it makes so much sense really for people just like us in that spiritual way, because it's so nature-based. So can you give us a picture of sort of this title of witch, but also the philosophy behind being Wiccan?
Okay. Well, first off, a witch may be a Wiccan, and a Wiccan may be a witch, or maybe not.
Okay.
Not all witches identify as Wiccans, and not all Wiccans identify as witches.
All right.
Confused yet?
Not yet.
Okay. The idea behind, the truth is, if I have to go to the doctor, for example, and they say religious preference, and if I say Wiccan, they go, oh, and they don't even blink, they know what that is.
Okay.
Right.
If I say witch, they all go, Hudah! And then they look at you with really big eyes.
Where's the broomstick?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I have one of those. It's in the living room, and there's one in my kitchen that I use to sweep the floor. Two different things altogether. The truth is that some witches do identify as Wiccans, and some Wiccans do identify as witches, but they're not always the same. The truth is, a Wiccan will adhere strictly to the harm none rule, which is, and they will go out of their way to avoid doing anything that could cause harm on any level.
Hmm.
While a witch, on the other hand, they may not have as many compunctions. A witch, on the other hand, feels that if you put them in the position that they have to defend their safety or their family or their job or their security or their children, then anything's fair game. Witches and Wiccans don't pretty much get into this whole turn the other cheek melodrama.
Mm-hmm.
They will defend themselves if necessary, but they will go out of their way to avoid having to do that, because witches believe in karma, and they also believe in that they need to be more neutral, that they shouldn't lean far to one side or far to the other. They should work from a place of neutrality and try to live as conscientiously and as responsibly as possible. Their whole goal is not to get put in a situation that would make them have to defend themselves with magic. And while some Wiccans, not all, really get hung up on the love and light and that they would never do anything that could cause harm in any way under anything, well, the truth is, you can't walk down a street without maybe accidentally stepping on a bug. So,
right.
I mean, it just depends on the practitioner. I'm not vain enough to claim to speak for every witch or Wiccan out there. It's a really complex situation, and most witches and Wiccans have their own idea on what exactly that means.
And maybe that's,
it's kind
of
like if you put three Christians in a room and said, okay, what exactly does it mean to you to be a Christian? They'll all have similar things to say, but they won't all have exactly the same thing to say.
Sure.
Well, Ella, can you give us some historical perspective on this? How far back does this witch and Wiccan thing go? And
okay, the title Wiccan and Wicca is a fairly new term. It came around in the 1950s. From a gentleman called Gerald Gardner, who lived in the United Kingdom in England specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And he started his own tradition and based it on the ancient folklore and magic and oral traditions handed down from the witches from Europe. And he started to call this religion Wicca, and it was called the Craft of the Wise.
So, Ellen, how does that relate to, like, the Druids and all that?
Okay,
I mean,
well,
does it?
A lot of, see, again, we're getting into topics that could take hours to discuss.
Yeah.
Wicca is a modern religion based on the teachings and the folklore and the magic of ancient pagan practices. Mm-hmm. And pagan meaning that they worshipped more than one god. Their gods were the gods of the land and the sky and the sea and the trees and the streams and the forest. And so when people say pagan, that doesn't mean godless. It actually means more than one. So, but I mean, it's very involved. It takes more than, you know, 30 seconds to explain the whole process. A druid may not necessarily be a witch. I have met witches who identified more on a druid path, but the druids, that's a whole other realm.
Well, does the Wicca faith have a Bible as such?
Oh no. There is no Wiccan Bible, and I often tell people, they say, oh, where's your church? And I say, well, it's outside. Outside is my church. Nature is my church. The beautiful thing about witchcraft and Wicca is it is reverence for the natural world and the earth and the four seasons and the cycles of nature, and it also is this fantastic ability to have your own relationship with the gods and goddesses and to walk your own path and to build your religion as you see fit. There is no bowing and scraping. There is no, oh, well, I have to do it this way because so-and-so says. No, you're very much encouraged to stand on your own and think for yourself and follow a path that works for you, keeping in mind that that path encourages that people have free will, that they are allowed to do as they choose, that people keep an open mind, and technically that you work to harm none.
So let's talk about how some of this translates to the natural world, spills out into the garden specifically. Because, I mean, you've written over a dozen books for Llewellyn Publishing, Ellen, and many of them involve the garden.
Always. Witchcraft in Wicca is a nature-based religion. Therefore, the natural world and the garden and the forest and the trees and the streams and the plains and the mountains and the beach, all these places are representations and beautiful representations of nature and nature at its holiest and nature, you know, that just shows you there's so much every time you go outside. There's so much to see. There's so much to learn. And this is the representation of nature. I mean, you know, we have a god of the sun and a goddess of the moon and, you know, there's gods of the forest. It's all tied in together. So for me, when I first began studying the craft about 25 years ago, it only made sense. You know, if this is indeed a nature religion, well, I'm certainly not going to find it inside of a building, am I? I'm going to have to go outside. And for me, the connection that I always felt with the natural world, with trees, with plants, with animals, that only added to my feeling, knowing that I was in the right place and this was indeed the right path for me. And for me, as when I started writing, the main reason I started writing was nobody was writing books like I wanted to read. And I kept thinking, okay, why is no one writing the stuff that I want to read? Why is no one looking at the folklore behind the mushrooms? Why is no one looking at the folklore behind trees and the flowers and all these things? We're supposed to be a nature religion. How does all this tie in, and why is no one writing about it? Because this is what I want to learn more about. And so I thought, all right, well, I'll just write the book. I'll go down there, and I'll start studying. So when I started writing, I started exploring the garden and all the energies and the folklore and the magic that could be found in your own garden at home. And a lot of people will say, oh, there's something so enchanting about a garden. Yes, there is. And it's really funny because when you get serious gardeners together, and I'm a master gardener for the state of Missouri, and when I lecture to even the most sedate, mundane crowds, if you mention fairy gardens to a room, everybody perks up and starts taking notes. Serious gardeners love plant folklore. They love to know more about the history of the plants. They want to know about the fairy tie-ins. So, I mean, there's a lot of meshing and melding going back and forth between the world of the gardens and witchcraft, because it all is a nature religion. It all ties in together. All that folklore, all that history, you can use, you can learn from.
Well, there's so many possibilities for creating the magic garden.
Always.
Where do you begin? What plants, what stones, what mushrooms do you pick?
What are some of the stories?
Well, roses. Extremely magical flower, cone flowers, brown-eyed Susans, your yarrow plants.
In what way,
you know,
are they magic?
Hostas, lily of the valley, coral bells, I mean, monk's hood, whatever you've got, and all the trees in your backyard, elm trees, maple trees, oak trees, all magical trees, all have magical properties.
Can you give us some examples?
Of thousands of examples.
Yeah, I mean, just pick a couple.
Okay,
you know,
pine tree. The pine tree promotes prosperity, health, healing, and protection. That's the reason that the ancient people brought evergreen boughs in their homes over the winter solstice. It was an act of sympathetic magic. At the coldest time of the year, the only thing that was green and still living was the evergreen and the holly, and they would clip the branches and bring it inside their homes and hang it up to reaffirm, because, you know, back in the day, they didn't have a calendar or a news person to say, oh, yes, in a couple of weeks, spring will be here. Mm-hmm. They were lucky to survive the winter after all. So bringing that greenery into their house was a way to celebrate that nature would indeed return, that life would come back to the land. Mm-hmm. And as time went on, the pine and the evergreen became tied in with life and healing and magic and prosperity. Mm-hmm. And so all these folklores got tied into this plant, and this all, and it became folklore, and it became legend, and it all became magical correspondences as time went by, mm-hmm. which is why people still bring evergreens and pine trees into their home at the winter solstice every year. For people that think that that is a Christian tradition, surprise, it is not a Christian tradition, because honestly, up until the 1950s, churches were not allowed to decorate with evergreen boughs or greenery or even a decorated tree because it was considered too pagan. Mm-hmm.
But people still get sick and die with pine boughs in their house.
Yeah, and people still get sick and die in the hospital.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's no guarantee here.
No.
But, okay, other plants that represent different spiritual qualities. I know the oak tree just for strength.
Right, for strength and healing, again, because that is a tree that is aligned with the planet Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And so you work stuff into that. So acorns or oak leaves or oak bark, any of those things could be used in any kind of spell or charm to promote healing or protection or wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
The elm tree is supposed to be a tree that's sacred to the fairies and to the elves. So if you needed maybe some wisdom, or you wanted to maybe do some magic that would link you in more firmly to the fairy communities and the fairy realms, you could maybe work with the leaves of an elm tree.
Mm-hmm.
You could work with rose petals or roses for love and for affection and for friendship. And then depending on the color of the rose, because color magic is a whole other realm, every color has its own meaning. And then depending on the color of the rose, you could fine-tune your magic to that.
Mm-hmm. What's your? Can you describe what your garden's like at home?
It's massive.
Yeah.
It goes completely around the front, the side, and the backyards. It's huge. It's basically a cottage-style garden,
mm-hmm.
which means it's pretty much unstructured, and I have a little of this and a little of that. My house is about 50 years old, so I have pretty large trees on the property. And I have one more formal-looking garden at the bottom of the yard where I get a little bit more sun
mm-hmm.
That has boxwood hedges and a big curved arbor and a brick pathway. And I have autumn clematis that grows over that, you know, that curved archway. And it's much more formal and precise looking as compared to the rest of the yard, which is very cottagey and very wild. But I very much like that very formal garden at the bottom of the yard. And the styles do work together. They don't clash because you're so used to seeing, you know, this mass of blooms that blooms from April through, you know, late November every year. And then you go to one part of the yard and like, oh, it's kind of a secret. It's kind of a surprise. You come mm-hmm. across this very ordered, very precise herb garden at the bottom of the yard. Mm-hmm. So it's fun.
So are there any plants out there, Ellen, that you absolutely could not live without based on their meaning, their folklore, their value in the garden just for enjoyment? But
probably,
you know,
roses.
Oh, really?
Are one of my favorite. It's
uh-huh.
a great magical plant, easy to get, easy to grow. They do very well in my garden. Another one, probably one of my favorite magical herbs would be yarrow. Just plain old yellow yarrow.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite varieties is a variety called Moonshine. It does really well. It blooms typically before midsummer every year,
mm-hmm.
and the blooms hold on for about 6 weeks. It dries beautifully. It's good for arts and crafts. It's great to use in magic because it's considered an all-purpose flower and all-purpose herb.
Uh-huh.
That's one of my favorites, but I work with everything in my yard. I work with the leaves on the trees. I work with the flowers. I work with the foliage. I have hundreds of varieties of plants in my garden, and I use them all. But at that same token, I mean, you can even use hydrangea blossoms and hydrangea leaves for magic if you choose to,
mm-hmm.
because almost every plant has a magical meaning and folklore behind it, and that can all be incorporated into your craft.
Are there other realms, too, then, Ellen, in terms of the natural world?
Well, sure.
Do you know what I mean? Like,
sure, there's the spirit realm, there's the fairy realm. I mean, you know, there's whatever. I mean, people ask me all the time, so do you believe in ghosts? I'm like, yeah.
So what would be the fairy realm, and how does that relate to
the
garden?
The fairy realm is thought to be somewhere between the natural world and the spirit world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not one that people just waltz into. There's a lot of over-romanticizing about this. People are like, oh, I want to go to the fairy realm. Good luck with that. If people actually get to the fairy realm, they don't come out. I mean, go read your Irish folklore. Go take a look at the Irish tales and legend of the fairies. They're not these cute little beings with Tinkerbell wings. They're badass. I mean, this is a whole different race of people. A whole different race of beings. And, you know, the fairy realm is thought to be accessible at certain times of the year, like Beltane, May the 1st, on Samhain, October 31st, which a lot of people call Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
These are times when the veil between our world and the spirit world and the realm of the Fae is thought to be very thin.
A little bit more.
And that you're supposed to be able to pass back and forth, which is why anybody with any imagination can go outside on Halloween night, just stand there and you're like, there's something in the air tonight. Mm-hmm. You know there's something out there. It's just an awareness that you know that something's there and moving. That's how the Samhain celebration started. People gathered together. It was the end of the agricultural year. They lit community bonfires. People gathered together. They had one last big hurrah before, you know, winter was setting in, because Samhain literally means summer's end. Huh. And they got together and they partied and they remembered their loved ones who'd passed on, and they, you know, got together to, you know, with hopes for the new year. And at the end of the night, they would take hollowed out turnips, because the pumpkin is a Native American, a New World plant, not an old European plant. But they would take hollowed out turnips and they would drop a coal in it, because the turnip was so thick it wouldn't burn. And they would use those turnips like little lanterns, and they would carry them home on the path home, because, you know, middle of the night, bonfire, you're walking back home. You don't have a Coleman lantern back in the day. You had to have something to get yourself home.
No flashlights.
They would use that to get home. And as the Irish and Scottish immigrants all came to the Americas in the 1700s and 1800s, they brought all those traditions of Samhain, as it became known, Halloween, they brought it with them. But when they came to the United States, here was this gorgeous fruit, this bright orange pumpkin, easy to carve, cheap, readily available, and people started using the pumpkin to turn it into a jack-o'-lantern.
So two separate but related questions. How did fairies get to be so cute,
because
over
people
time?
Tend to either demonize things that make them afraid,
or make them,
or they turn them into
cuddly.
Something cutesy, kind of like angels. It always makes me laugh when I hear people go, I love angels, I have my guardian angel, and they have this cute little picture of an angel. I'm like, dude, an archangel? That's not something you ever want to see. They're supposed to have like 1,000 eyes and be on fire. Mm-hmm. That's not something that you want to be like prancing around with and playing with. That's a major force of nature right there.
So propaganda, I guess.
So people do what they can to make them seem less frightening. So they make them cute, and they make them tiny.
So
people often call them the good folks or the little folks.
Mm-hmm. So, on the flip side then, Halloween, how did it get demonized?
Christian propaganda.
Okay. And do you celebrate Halloween in that traditional sort of sense, as you described?
To be honest, my house is one of the biggest stops in the neighborhood. We put up, I have a scarecrow. We call him 6 Foot Stanley. His head is one of those those artificial pumpkins that lights up, and we have him on a timer. So when it gets dark, his head lights up, and then we have orange lights on the house, and we have big corn stalks and lots of pumpkins. And as my kids were small, we lived in a neighborhood that was a little bit older, and there wasn't a lot of young families. You know, sometimes you move in a neighborhood, and you're like the only young family. Well, the only way we could get trick-or-treaters to come to the house was to really decorate up the house. And as time went on, we became known as the people with all the pumpkins and the scarecrow on the corner. Now, people give directions by our house. Mm-hmm. I have kids walk up to me in the grocery store in September asking, when's your scarecrow? Because the scarecrow always goes up on the first day of fall, which is, somewhere around the 20th to the 23rd of September every year. And that, when's your scarecrow going up? When is your Halloween decorations going up? Every kid in the neighborhood knows who I am, and they all know, who I am, because I've been in the local paper, and I'm going to be on the St. Louis News here in a couple weeks for a morning interview in the studio. They all know who I am. It's not a secret. And we have families that come to our house every year. They pose their kids in front of our house. They take pictures. They're back every year. And our house is really fun. It's decorated up. It's not grim or gory. And people drive by in cars. And for weeks, we hear kids screaming at the car windows, I want to go to that house, as they drive by. On Halloween night, I stay home. I pass out candy to all the kids in the neighborhood, because they would be devastated if I did not. They really look forward to coming. My family gathers together. I put out a big spread of food, and then we all get together. And then after everybody goes home and the trick-or-treaters are done, I usually take some private time, and I usually get out pictures of my grandparents who've all passed away, or some family pets who are no longer with us, and I hold a private Samhain ritual and honor the memories of my loved ones, because that is actually what Samhain does. It honors the memory of the people who have passed on that were important in your life. Mm-hmm. That is what Samhain is all about. It's an end-of-the-year festival. It's a time where you honor the loved ones, that are no longer with you. That's how come ghosts and graveyards and skeletons abound, because it is a festival of the dead. It's a day you remember your beloved dead.
It's catching up to Christmas as a commercial venture, however.
It is the second most popular holiday in the United States.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, thank you. We'll try to remember it for what
you.
It truly is, Ellen.
Thanks.
We appreciate your time. Ellen Dugan is the author of The Garden Witch's Herbal, Garden Witchery, and Cottage Witchery, among other books published by Llewellyn Press. She's a clairvoyant and a practicing Wiccan who lives with her family in St. Louis, Missouri. For more information on Ellen or her work, please see our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, more plants for an enchanted garden. Paul Bonine considers the color black. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Many sights to see. And when I look in my window, so many different people to be, that it's strange, so strange. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. You got to pick up every stitch. Must be the season of the witch. Must be the season of the witch, yeah. Must be the season of the witch.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
So, Bob, do you have any black plants out at Hidden Hill?
I've got mondo grass, which I like a lot, and I've got some hellebores, which are close to black.
So close to black.
I've got a few, and I really am trying to integrate them better into the landscape. So they show up because, by definition, black plants can kind of disappear into blackness.
Right. I can't, you know, I don't really have anything hardcore black. I've got the close to black, as you say. You know what I mean?
Right.
That's kind of reddish. The hellebore, sure. I've got some of the geraniums. He mentioned some hardy geraniums in there that I have that kind of have like a variegated sort of black thing. There's one plant in this book that I have to get.
Uh-oh.
It's a salvia, and it's black. You know how I love the black and,
black
blue,
and blue
salvia,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Which is the blue bloom with the black calyx?
Right, right.
This is a black bloom with a silver calyx.
Ooh,
I have
you.
Got to get that plant.
It's you.
It's beautiful.
We've got a man.
Black and silver. Come on.
We've got a man here who can help you out. He's
good.
Paul Bonine. He's co-owner of Zero Plants in Oregon. He's written a lot of articles for national magazines. He's been a consultant for NPR. He's also author of a new book by Timber Press called Black Plants. He's with us today from his nursery in Oregon to talk about it. Paul, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you.
Let's first talk about black plants. I mean, what did nature have in mind when she created them?
Well, it's hard to say what nature had in mind. What it is an overabundance of a chemical in plants called anthocyanins. Mm-hmm. And they're the same chemicals you find in leaves that make leaves dark in the fall, or in vegetables like beets that make the red tones. And so we're not really sure what caused them to be black, but some plants just have a higher concentration in them.
So does that mean that they have less chlorophyll, or is it just that they have more of the anthocyanins in them?
They have more of the anthocyanins in them. They still have chlorophyll.
Okay.
They have enough chlorophyll to work, but the anthocyanins just show up more strongly.
Okay.
And then why this book? How did this happen? It's a very interesting subject.
Well, a friend approached me, and they'd been interested in the book, and I had always been interested in black plants. And he knew at our nursery that we grew a lot of them. So he approached me, and we decided that it was a good idea. And so it went from there.
And, I mean, there's probably not too many books out there that highlight black plants. So I guess that begs the question, Paul. How many black plants are there out there, in fact?
Well, then more than just the 75 that we highlighted in the book, there's
yeah.
probably thousands of different kinds. There are many that, in fact, after the book came out, I keep noticing more and more that could have been included. But there's tons and tons, including Japanese maples and blackleaf plums and all sorts of plants.
So is there any common denominator between the black plants across the board that suggests anything other than just, you know, having more of that chemical compound, more tropical or subtropical or more Midwestern or shade plants or sun plants? pH, anything?
No, not really. They run the gamut. They go from tropical to Arctic plants. There seems to be a large concentration of them in New Zealand, and no one really knows why. There's also a large concentration of white-flowered plants in New Zealand, and no one knows why, but that would be the only common denominator that I could find.
Okay.
Now, a lot of your plants, I mean, the book is black plants, but obviously a lot of them end up having some reds and yellows and whites and purples in them too, because there aren't that many pure black plants in the world. So what's the blackest one you found? Mine would be like Mondo grass.
I'd have to agree. I think Mondo grass is the blackest, true black.
Yeah.
Another one would be the black viola. That's another one that's true black. You can't see any purple or red in it whatsoever. It's true, true black. A lot of the other ones kind of hedge on black. They're closer to maroon or burgundy.
Right.
So the Mondo grass is foliage, but is the petunia, that would be
the flower.
The flower. So black flowers? I mean,
black flowers.
Is that very, very common? I mean, because that would be, is that the same sort of inclination when you speak of the anthocyanins?
The flower has a concentration.
Okay.
And in fact, in one of the plants, the plants we grow, Camellia Night Rider, in the camellia, the flowers itself are red shaded with black, but there's so much anthocyanin in the entire plant that the roots are bright red.
Huh.
And so it just permeates the entire plant.
Well, let's kind of go through some of the plants in order. I went through the book and picked ones that are more likely to be grown in our area because of the zone difference. You guys are, what, Zone 7?
Zone Oregon. 8, yeah.
You're Zone 8 in Oregon, and I envy you that many days, I'll tell you that. But one of the first plants you have is Bugbane, the Hillside Black Beauty. Talk about that one.
Well, that's a great perennial, and it has almost true black foliage, and the foliage is really fine and tiered, and it's extremely cold-hardy. I think it's Zone 2 or Zone 3.
Right.
And it's a good border perennial, and it contrasts well with other plants in a border. And since the light, delicate foliage is kind of tiered, it goes with bolder foliage things behind it very well. In late summer, it has tall, tall spikes of flowers that are white tails, and it looks good throughout the entire season. It's completely deciduous in the winter.
Mm-hmm. How about companion plants for that one? What would you think?
Oh, boy. Dark-leaved dahlias look nice with that. Chartreuse leaf plants. You could underplant it with Creeping Jenny, the gold leaf Creeping Jenny.
Well,
that'd
be fun,
good.
Yeah.
And in front of any gold leaf plant, I think it really looks good.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Creeping Jenny, one of my favorite ground covers, and one in your book is Ajuga Black Scallop.
Mm-hmm.
That's a low-growing black plant. Talk about that a little bit.
Ajuga Black Scallop, well, I like that one because it's a little more restrained than the normal Ajuga. It kind of stays in its place a little bit better, and it forms a real tight mat, a real tight ground cover, and it looks good throughout the season. In our climate, it's evergreen.
Ah.
It stays good looking year-round.
Okay.
And it has the dark blue flower spikes that come up, and they kind of are a little bit hidden with the dark foliage, but that dark blue looks great with the glossy leaves, and they're kind of a concave.
And then a tree form, I've just noticed this in the last 2 years. I grow this myself now. I love it. It's the Mimosa Summer Chocolate, which is actually more of a dark purple, but what a stunning tree that is.
What a stunning tree that is. Isn't that amazing thing? I just planted one in my garden.
Yeah.
Hollyhocks. Yeah. You've got a favorite kind of romantic cottage garden plant. There are some black hollyhocks.
Yeah, and those are close to true black, too.
Mm-hmm.
And those have been grown for a long, long time, and that's a really easy plant to grow. And it likes full hot sun, blasting hot sun, and kind of dry soil,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of good air circulation so it doesn't get rust. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they get rust there, but they do in our climate.
Yeah.
So it's good to, for good air circulation. And they look good against fences and in groves and in groups,
mm-hmm.
and against barns and old-fashioned-looking places. And the black one is a sturdy perennial.
Mm-hmm. So, Paul, are the black plants ones that have been selected cultivars, are these actually occurring, you know, naturally, or is there hybridization being done?
Both, actually. Some occur in nature, they just occur,
mm-hmm.
and some are selected out for being black.
Mm-hmm.
Black hellebores are an example. They're they've been selected out through breeding over time for the black varieties, and so they don't really occur as much in nature, maybe as an occasional darker flowered variety. And then they're selected out, and then they're bred for the darker and darker varieties, while others are just species that that come out as black. Fritillaria persica is just a black flowering bulb.
Yeah, we should tell listeners in your book, Black Plants, 75 Striking Choices for the Garden, there are pictures of each one of these plants, so you can get an idea what they look like, dim and dark indeed. I'm a big columbine fan, too, and you got one, Clementine Dark Purple.
That's a great columbine, and it stays dark, and it blooms for a long, long time. It's one of the alkaloidias, you can cut the flower off and it'll send up another spike.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And we grew those for years and years. Unfortunately, you have to make sure that you isolate it a little bit from other columbines because it will cross over time.
Oh.
And you get mixing and it'll reseed. But you can start over again. You can get another one and start over again and keep it pure in time.
Here's one I've seen in other people's gardens or in nurseries I wish I'd grown. I keep forgetting to do it. It's the ornamental pepper, the black pearl with those really funky black, were they seed pods or flowers or?
Peppers.
Those black peppers are amazing.
Or peppers. Go figure.
They are amazing. They are beautiful plants. They're beautiful annuals. Some people eat them.
Ah.
I'm not a pepper fan, so I don't know how they taste, but the plants themselves are spectacular. The foliage is glossy green, and the fruits stay on there for months and months. I think they should be used a lot more often.
Mm-hmm.
Then the elephant ear, Calocasia Black Magic, which is another one I like to use for just its dark, dark leaf.
Oh, that's a beautiful leaf, and the water that beads up on it.
Yeah.
And it just kind of rolls off like mercury. Yeah, I think that's a beautiful plant. And that's something that does so well back east, where you have the warmer nights and it's humid.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And here it does okay here, but needs a lot of water. It just thrives back east, though, and it looks so good.
And then the dahlia, the Bishop of Llandaff. You don't think much about dahlias being dark, but this one, and I've seen it, it's been around a long time. It's a nice cultivar, and it's really got the dark purple foliage more than anything, if I remember right.
Yeah, it's got nice little flowers, too, but the foliage is really intricate and dark, and there's quite a few dark-leaf dahlias, but that one is one of the most special, I think. It's a nice compact habit, and very dark, dark, velvety flowers that are double, and then the fine black foliage, and it's compact. I think it's one of the best.
Paul, in terms of combining these plants, you had mentioned how well they go with sort of those chartreuse colors, and I could agree with that to be sure. But what about combining a mix of different black plants? Have you been able to successfully do that at your gardens?
That's a little more tricky because that seems to work better in containers. We combine them. Combining them in a border is tricky because you end up with kind of a black hole. You end up with something that kind of sucks light right into, and you kind of disappear. And so what I've found is better is to mix them in specific areas with contrast behind them.
Okay.
So that they show up well. And that's a little bit tricky. You have to look at the backdrop and look at the plants that are in the back and in front of them and use them as an accent where you want like a shadow or a deeper kind of a depth in the border.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I've been able to use them the best.
Okay.
Yeah, going back to mondo grass again, I've tried that with that, it's a Hockney clover grass, that gold.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking the black and the gold together would be terrific, but the mondo grass just always sort of disappears into the landscape. I can't make it jump out and do its black thing because it's black.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The best I've seen with that, again, is with the Creeping Jenny. And I've seen people here do it with golden baby steers also.
Mm-hmm. That's a good idea, because the Jenny would be lower than the black mondo.
Right.
That's a great idea.
Yeah,
and I saw someone who had a container like that, and they had the Creeping Jenny pouring out and the black mondo grass coming out of the top, and it worked perfectly.
I'm going to run home after the show. And
yeah, don't forget that. So, I mean, the challenge really of, I guess, designing a mixed border with some of these dark plants is making sure that you set them against a backdrop that lets them pop out, otherwise they get lost, huh?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And then my favorite name in your book is Sooty Sweet William. Can you defend that one at all?
The sooty. Yeah, that's funny because I don't know where the sooty comes from. The foliage is dark, and I guess it looks a little bit sooty. What I like best about that one are the flowers, the kind of red velvet black flowers.
Mm-hmm.
And so it could have been maybe a more positive name.
Maybe the flowers looked sort of sooty.
Yeah, maybe.
With the
do.
Black, yeah. Huh. Is there any incidence of like a plant turning into an albino or mutating into an albino with any of these black plants or, you know, variegation? Have you noticed anything like that?
Well, a black plant that's variegated.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that'd be fantastic.
That would be fantastic, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I've not seen something like that.
That's probably okay. Something you could retire on.
That would be something you could retire on.
That's your mission when you go home.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Then there's a hot shrub that I like a lot, the Physocarpus ninebark,
Diablo. Oh,
there's others.
Shrub.
Beautiful, kind of a deep purple, really.
Well, that's a beautiful, beautiful plant, what I like about it is the contrast with little white flowers. I have a friend who lives in Wisconsin, and she gardens there, and I took one to her in her garden, and it does so well there, and it looks so good. And that one has a nice sheen on the leaves, so you don't have to worry quite as much about the backdrop that you put it in. So it shows up in the foreground, I think, really well.
Right.
And then
it makes
the
a
white
nice
blend.
Arching shrub, and it's tough. It takes drought, and it takes boggy places, so it's a really good plant.
Mm-hmm. So the Sambucus is sort of that similar in terms of the bloom and, I think, the airy habit. This one, there's a black one called Black Lace.
Oh, yeah.
Is that proving to be a good variety? I remember a couple of years ago, didn't like a kind of a yellowish or chartreuse colored one come out, and then it really wasn't all that great?
Yeah, well, Black Lace is turning out to be a really good one.
Okay.
The problem in our climate is that it was sold as a 6-foot tall shrub.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it grows about 6 feet in a year here.
Okay. So for us, it would be maybe a little slower.
But okay. It's one of those things I might just watch a little bit carefully and see.
Okay.
See how fast it grows, because I have a feeling that's going to be a much, much bigger than a 6-foot shrub.
Okay. So Sambucus, Black Lace. So that could make a fabulous black, I guess, sort of wild-looking hedge for anyone as well.
I've grown that. It's black. It's nice. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. A beautiful black hedge or a specimen.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a specimen against a white wall or against maybe a stone wall.
Mm-hmm.
It would look really good.
Paul, one last one for us. The Tulip Queen of the Night.
Mm-hmm.
The picture showed a pretty darn black.
It's pretty black, yeah.
Yeah.
It's black from a distance, especially.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, about 10 or 15 feet, and it's black.
Yeah.
You know, and especially if you put light pink tulips or orange tulips with it, it's really, really black. Up close, you can start to see the little bit of maroon and purple.
That might be a good plant for, like, a university that's really proud of their sports team.
Wouldn't it?
They have, you know, a
black and red.
Black and red, maybe here in Louisville or somewhere else.
You could do that, black and red tulips.
There you go.
Uh-huh.
You could do that. Well, thank you very much. We enjoy talking to you. And
thank you.
And spread the word about the black plants.
That's right. Thanks, Paul.
Thank you.
Paul Bonine, co-owner of Zira Plants in Oregon, is also the author of a new Timber Press book, Black Plants, 75 Striking Choices for the Garden. For more information on Paul, or his nursery, or his book, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, we've got listeners' questions and a new Latin word of the week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
And here to answer questions.
Yes, indeed.
From your question box.
From my question box.
Yes, ma'am.
This one is from Charlotte Bob. She writes, I cut weeping willow branches from our front yard tree, potted them up. I heard this on your show as a little side note.
Right.
They looked dead for a while, but finally sprouted green. I know I need to get them in the ground before the roots freeze, but when and how do I go about this? Especially to make sure that they make it through the winter. She also has a potted dogwood sprout, Bob, that she dug. So she wants to know, you know, basically what she needs to do. Should she actually plant them in the ground now, mulch them, whatever, to give them the best chance of getting through the winter?
Yeah, I'd say it depends on the size of the root. If you've got some pretty decent roots from the willow, go ahead and put it in the ground, maybe in a sheltered spot, and mulch it. If the roots are just barely starting out, you might just consider leaving it, potting it up and putting it in a nice, safe place.
Mm-hmm.
My worry about the dogwood is it may have been a grafted dogwood, and she may be getting a sprout from the understock rather than the dogwood she wants above the graft.
Right.
So if it comes out of the ground and it's grafted, you're not going to get what you want.
Yeah. And if it's just like a seedling from something else, yeah, don't expect anything grand necessarily. But if you have, I mean, because we let seedlings come up in the pine grove, but that's because we have a lot of space and they do just fine. But yeah, as Bob said, it's not going to be exactly what you saw.
But it's always kind of fun anyway to raise one yourself from scratch, your little babies.
Mm-hmm.
I like to do that.
Yeah. Because if she has a garage, that might be, you can like put them in another big container with mulch. And, you know, sink them to protect the root system and then put them in your garage so that they still kind of go through that outdoor experience through the winter, but right. not the harshest outdoor experience through the winter if you think that they're a little too small. And then just make sure that you keep them watered.
Absolutely.
All right, Bob, here's another question. This one's from the Hedge family, Joe Hedge. They write us from time to time. Joe writes, I have three crepe myrtles, and one in particular, he wants to cut back and keep it from being so large. So he asks, you know, when and how should he trim it?
As soon as the show's over,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, now's a good time to do it. Crepe myrtles, you know, you can do it now, late fall or early spring.
Mm-hmm.
Prune it up. They're done blooming. They're going to bloom on new wood anyway, so
right.
you're safe. Just kind of balance it out. And pruning on a nice, sunny fall afternoon is kind of fun anyway.
Yeah, or in February when you're getting a little antsy.
I like
that. Just keep in mind when you're pruning it, don't just lop off branches, you know, like top it, so to speak, but shape it up.
Right.
And if you need to reduce it height-wise, make sure you're making a cut at a branch juncture where it'll heal over properly, or just remove it all the way from the base if it's a multi-stemmed sort of thing.
I use the 2-2 process. I take off two limbs and step back two steps.
Mm-hmm.
Take off two limbs and step back two steps.
That's a good little rule.
Circle as I go.
Uh-huh. That's a very good little rule.
Yeah. I know.
Two.
Or a big rule.
Our big rule. Second part of the question, Bob. He also has a nice Wyoming canna. It still has blooms on it for now, but he is like me, has a no-dig rule. He's going to take his chances on it returning. He's not planning on digging it. So the question is, when should he cut it back to the ground after the first big frost? Should he actually mulch it to try to protect it to get it through the season? Any ideas?
Well, if there's a big frost coming, I cut them down before the first big frost.
Oh, really?
The day before, actually. Because, you know, you can take a chance, I guess, and wait, but it might get zapped, and they're so full of water, some of that cold might get right down into the ground. But if you can wait, do it the next morning. But as soon as possible, before or right after the frost, take it down to the ground. That'll buy you some time. And, yes, mulching is probably invaluable. I've had them survive many years next to the house, but the further out I get away from the house, mm-hmm. the more prone they are to dying.
Yeah. And the drainage, I think, has something to do with it, too.
A lot to do with it.
Yeah. So if it's too waterlogged, basically, throughout the winter, it'll just rot out. So,
right.
Yeah, you're taking your chances, but, oh, well, I'm with you on the whole no-dig thing.
It's the sunny side of global warming. Plants survive that didn't used to in the winter.
Unless they
rot. The only sunny side of global warming.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you have a question, what shall they do, Bob?
Visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Or call us at 814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, I'm going to spell out the Latin word of the week this time in English so people
in English
know what to expect.
Okay.
It's again, the show, B-L-A-C-K.
It means black.
You got it.
And actually, there's a couple of different Latin words. I thought, you know, I'd include some examples of different ways we can describe black plants.
Yes.
So Niger, nigrescens, both of which mean black.
Right.
Probably the one that pops to my mind, and we discussed the hellebore earlier today, but hellebore niger, which is the Christmas rose, sometimes referred to as the black hellebore, because of that naturally occurring deep,
right.
kind of maroon to black blooms.
I like them in hellebores, too.
Yeah, I do, too. Acer negrum.
The black maple.
Black maple. You'll see negrum often used as well to describe black. Solanum nigrescens.
What a great name. The divine nightshade.
Is that not, and like, okay, you know how nightshade sort of poisonous?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking,
well, that's evil mystery.
You know, maybe Ellen knows a little bit more about divine nightshade than we do.
Yeah.
But Solanum nigrescens, divine, and I just like the name, divine nightshade.
Yeah, it's got all the elements of intrigue and mystery.
It sure does, doesn't it? Okay, nigro punctatus.
The spotted black.
Spotted black, it means, yeah. Nigro, black, punctatus means spot.
Okay.
So if you see something that's nigro punctatus, it will be
spotted black.
Nigro marginata.
Oh, it's got a black edge.
Black edge.
The margin.
For example, there's always a carex.
Yep.
Carex nigro marginata, the black edge sedge. How about that one?
Black edge sedge.
Uh-huh.
Sounds like one of my stupid poems.
But it sounds really nice, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And that may be almost, maybe not quite the black and white variegation that we're looking at, but if you've got a plant that has that black edge, you know, to that green. I bet you that's pretty darn striking.
What if you planted divine nightshade next to black edge sedge?
I think that would be...
They'd be lined up to Shelbyville to see your garden.
So yeah, I think I'm pretty intrigued by the whole black plant thing. How about you?
Yes.
Yeah. So here are some words to look for in your quest for black plants. Niger, nigrescens, nigro punctatus, nigro marginata, perhaps?
Absolutely.
Sounds good.
I'll
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, Michael Gage, who is a Floyd's Fork naturalist, and a little on the American chestnut.
Homegrown is produced by the divine Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.